Okay. We're going to attempt to finish this study. Not today, we won't finish it, but we're in the very last part of this. We've had the last 2 weeks, we had Vacation Bible School, and then I was gone last week. Ted is going to be teaching class next Sunday morning. I'm not sure whether we're going to be going north or whether we're going to be going south at this point. Our plan is to go to South Carolina to be with Emma for her birthday, but my dad is getting worse and worse, and so I just don't know how much longer he's going to last. So we will not be here next Sunday. Ted will be teaching Bible class, and then when I get back, we will finish this part of our study. The last part of it that we're focusing on is Jesus and the prophets. We began this this section a few weeks ago, and looking at in Matthew chapter 16, we're looking at the relationship that Jesus had with the teachings of the prophets, the things that the prophets had to say, the positions that they took, and how did those kinds of things affect Jesus in his ministry. When you go to Matthew chapter 16, there verses 13 and 14 is where Jesus asked his disciples, we're going to real quickly review this part. We started last time. Jesus asked his disciples, who do men say that I am? In other words, what's the word on the street about me? You hear people talking. What are they saying about me as to how are they identifying me? Who do they see me as? The response that was given to him was that some thought that he was John the Baptist, perhaps had come back to life. Some thought that he might be Elijah, who was supposed to be sent before the great day of the Lord. Others thought that perhaps he might be Jeremiah or, at the very least, some other prophet. So the idea here is that the people in general, the population, the crowds, as we oftentimes refer to them, had a concept of Jesus that was directly associating him with the prophets and the teachings of the prophets, and what the prophecies were concerning the Messiah and the relationship of the Messiah to the prophets and so forth. One of the questions that we proposed in this whole thing was, why do you suppose that people were looking at Jesus and so much associating him with Elijah or Jeremiah? Why those two specific prophets in here? And I think that as we go through this section here and looking at Jesus and the prophets, then I think it will become more and more evident that those were not just two names that were pulled out of the hat, so to speak, and that were just kind of, oh, well, you know, ideas of prophets were coming in. Which prophets can you think of? And these were the two names that first popped up into people's heads. There's most likely a whole lot more to why people thought of Jesus and associated him with Elijah and with Jeremiah. When we look at Jesus and the prophets, there's three major aspects that we need to understand about the role of the prophets that they play during the time that they were ministering, and how does that particular part connect to what Jesus is doing in his ministry. We started talking about this particular part of it last time. And so the first of those three major aspects is the spiritual aspect. The prophets focused much of their attention on things having to do with the people's relationship with God. It was spirituality. They taught, they spoke, they focused a lot of energy and focus on things that had to do with threats to the relationship of the Israelite people with God. It was things like idolatry and hypocrisy in worship and things having to do with spiritual things in the life of Israel. The prophets continually focused on that and challenging and calling the people, the rulers and so forth, back to a proper relationship with Almighty God. And you recall in 1 Kings chapter 18, it was Elijah, the prophet on Mount Carmel, who called on the people then to make a choice. Okay? The choice having to do with, if Yahweh is God, then serve Him. If Baal is God, then serve him. But you cannot serve both. See? And so we find Elijah in that position of calling upon the people, look, you need to decide, you need to choose which way you're going to go. We've already seen, someone else give that same kind of challenge to the Israelite people not long after they got into the promised land. Anybody recall who that was? Joshua. Joshua challenged the people. If serving the gods of the people in whose land you dwell seems right to you, then so be it. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. You choose this day whom you will serve, he said. Whether the gods of the Amorites and in whose land you now dwell, you see, there's a choice. And Joshua put that before the people. And we see that happening. And here on Mount Carmel, Elijah challenges the people with that same thing. You choose who you're going to serve. You cannot serve both. Okay? Now we look ahead to Jesus in Matthew chapter 6 and verse 24, when Jesus calls upon the Israelites of His day to make the same choice when He says, no one can serve two masters. The choice has to be made. We have to decide. And Jesus, using that same idea, the same concept of challenging people to decide which way they're going to go, and giving them the choices between two entities or two things. You're either going to serve God or you're going to serve man, one or the other. But you cannot serve both. You have to make a choice. Jesus, like the prophets before Him, exposed the hypocrisy of Israel who claimed to worship God all the while they were ignoring His covenant law. And we spent a long time talking about the significance of the covenant law that God had given to Israel, and how one of the biggest problems that they had was not understanding and not accepting the relationship that covenant law was based on. They thought they could simply go through the motion of following the rules and leave the relationship out. And thus Jesus would call upon them. And again, recalling one of the prophets, Isaiah, saying, these people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. They're following the rules, but their heart is not in it. So therefore, they're not focused on the relationship at all. So one of the quotes that I read last time from the author of this book that I've been referring to a lot, he says, like the prophets, Jesus was consumed by a spiritual jealousy for the honor of God. Like them, He attacked quite mercilessly those who imagined that God was impressed by religion divorced from the moral and social values of God Himself. So Jesus, just like the prophets before Him, was so concerned about the lack of relationship that the Israelites had with God. And this whole concept of you know, making the sacrifices, following the rules, but going through the motions in doing so and leaving the relationship aspect of the heart out of the whole thing. Jesus over and over and over again hammered that concept home to the people of His day. So the spiritual aspect was one of the most vital aspects of what the prophets focused on, and Jesus just encompassed that into His message to the people. The second of those main issues was economic issues. Okay? So not only were there spiritual things to be focused on and concerned about, but there was the whole economic aspect of life amongst the Israelite people. The prophets were concerned from this particular standpoint with the forces and the processes in Israelite society that caused poverty, exploitation, debt, corruption, all of those kinds of things. These were the social issues. And again, over and over again, we saw the prophets addressing the behaviors of the Israelites and primarily leadership amongst the Israelites addressing these kinds of concerns. Why would that be so significant to them? Again, when you go back and you look at and understand the concept of the law that God gave, remember we were talking about the basis of the law that God gave to them was in this relationship, and that relationship basically said what? Anybody recall? The relationship said, look, I'm God and you are my chosen people. He gave them that law after He redeemed them from slavery, right? You see? And parts of that law, remember we were looking at the basis of some of those laws and so forth that had to do with God said, here's the reason that I want you to treat slaves and foreigners and poor people and so forth this way, because that's what you were. And this is how I treated you when you were in that condition, and so I want you to treat others the way that I treated you. It goes back to the whole issue of holiness before God. You say, remember us talking about that under the aspect of the law. And so in seeing the Israelites as a people failing in this particular area, naturally it was of great concern to the prophets, to calling them to account for the ways they're behaving that go against the law and go against what God had called upon them to do as they take care of one another. The land, then, was a main issue in the economic survival for Israel. Okay? And when you think about the land, okay, there are two main things that stand out there. First of all, the land was a gift to Israel. Okay? You go back to your earliest days in Bible class and so forth in there. One of the things that stands out over and over again as we teach our children, and probably you were taught, is that God had called the Israelite people and brought them to where? The Promised Land. You see? It was referred to as the Land of Promise. God had promised to Abraham that He would give him this land. To Abraham and his descendants. You see? So land then, this was an important aspect of the social life and the economic life of Israel. The promise to Abraham was kept by God through the Exodus and the conquest. The people received the land that was promised. But it was a land that was meant for all Israelites to enjoy. Okay? And that's why there were specific provisions in the law for the division of the land to all the tribes, all the families, everyone receiving their share. Okay? In other words, when you start looking at these kinds of things, you begin to recognize, hopefully, and understand that those aspects that we read about in the Old Testament where there's this division of the land, you're doing your daily Bible reading and you're going, well, so-and-so got this land and so-and-so got that land, and you're kind of getting bored with it and you're going, why is it so important that all this stuff was recorded so that I'd have to sit here in my daily Bible reading and have to go through all of this, right? Why is that so important? It's important because of what it meant to the people. Okay, and here is why. The land not only was God's gift, but the second thing was that the land belonged to God. Even though there was a division of the land, and each family and each tribe got their portion, the land still belonged to God. Leviticus chapter 25 and verse 23, the Lord says, "The land must not be sold permanently, because the land is mine, and you are but aliens and tenants." Wow. Okay? Now go back and reread in your daily Bible reading the division of the land and start thinking about it perhaps in some different terms here. When God says, this tribe is to have this land, and this tribe is to have that land, and this tribe is to have this land, realizing that it is in the context of you're just using it. You see? That land still belongs to me. Now, again, why is that so significant? The land, again, was the foundation. It really was the basic foundation of Israel's whole economic system. Okay? Their economy depended on the land. Thus, the importance of all of those laws concerning the use and the transfer of land in the law of Moses. See? Leviticus chapter 25, beginning in verse 8 and following, has a very interesting part here. Okay, and that's where it talks about the year of Jubilee. Okay, and what that required was the returning of the land to its owners. In other words, if there was someone who got themselves into debt and they had to, you know, sell off some of their land that was the possession that was given to their family according to the distribution of the land, okay, they would sell that land off to someone else in order perhaps to pay their debts and so forth. Well, what ends up happening to that particular person? They no longer have land of their own. What are likely they're going to have to do? Yeah, they're going to now have to work for somebody else in order to make a living, in order to survive. Okay? Now, at the end of the 50 years, or the end of the 49 years, the year of Jubilee comes, what happens to the land? It goes back to the original owner. You see? So therefore, whenever there, and this is very specific in the law, I'm going to sell you some of my land because I need the money, okay? And you guys want some of my land, so how many more years do we have before the year of Jubilee? We have to consider that because that's going to determine the value of the land. Because you're only going to get to keep it for that long. You're not going to get to keep it from now on. You don't get to will it to your children and so on, and it's yours now forever. Why? Because it doesn't belong to you to begin with. It doesn't belong to me to begin with. Who does it belong to? It belongs to God. And God says, I get to use it for this amount of time while I'm here, and you get to use it only for this amount of time. And once that time comes, that land goes back to my family. See? Now go back and start reading through that section again. Okay? And start seeing some different meaning and understanding in this. You see, because here's where the problem came in and where the prophets really voiced a lot of concern. From Solomon's day on, this system of God's justice deteriorated. Okay? You remember some of the warnings that were given to the Israelite people when they called upon Samuel to give them a king. Okay, what was the king going to do? Yeah, including your land, you say. Because he's going to need it in order for all of his vast empire and so forth. He's going to take your land. The problem was is that they didn't get it back. See, many of the laws concerning the returning of land and so forth were ignored, just like many of the other laws that God had given the Israelites were ignored. The land then was oftentimes taken from the poor, and the poor became oppressed by their debtors. The land was not returned to them as it should have been. In Nehemiah's day, Nehemiah chapter 5, verses 1 through 13, Nehemiah makes this attempt to stop the oppression of the poor. See. And keep in mind here, when Nehemiah was doing his thing, when was that in Israel's history? It was after the captivity, not before. So you see, even after, you know, the kingdom of Judah, the kingdom of Israel being destroyed, the people taken into captivity, they still hadn't learned their lesson. You see? The reason they were taken into captivity to begin with was because they were disobedient to God. They were ignoring God's laws. They come out of captivity and they're doing the same things. So by the time Jesus comes along in his day, do you think that's changed much? No. It's only gotten worse. You see, it's only gotten worse. In fact, the kings, during the period of the kingdom, the United Kingdom under Solomon, and then the divided kingdom, they were some of the worst offenders. Instead of protecting the people the way that they should have, they were some of the worst offenders. 1 Kings chapter 21 tells a story of Naboth's vineyard. And it's a prime example of that kind of abuse. And again, who do we see here standing up for the oppressed? It was Elijah. See, it was Elijah who stood before God against Ahab and Jezebel on this occasion. And here's a direct example of, again, the significance of land and how important it was to the survival of people, and how even the rulers were greedy to take what was not rightfully theirs. And we find the prophet Elijah standing up for them. We see a time period where the poor are getting poorer and the rich are getting richer. Faith in Yahweh sustained the system of economic and social justice. So when faith was waning or lacking, then we can see what would happen. To abandon Yahweh and turn to Baal was not just an idolatry issue, but also it opened the door for socioeconomic deterioration. In other words, if the basis of keeping these laws and keeping things the way God had established them was faith in Yahweh and obedience to His law, then turning away from God and turning to idols and leaving what God had said, not only is that idolatry, So it addresses the spiritual aspect of it, but then there's no real basis for keeping these rules and laws that God has established to protect the people. There's no basis for keeping those. So then it becomes not just a spiritual issue, but a socioeconomic issue. You see, and God's land, God's people then are being oppressed and misused. And what we see then is idolatry and injustice go hand in hand. When idolatry finds its way in, injustice is going to quickly follow. And the people are going to be oppressed. The situation was even worse during Jesus' time while he was here on earth because of Roman rule. Okay? So you not only had, as we talked about earlier in our study, you not only had the problem of the religious leaders of Jesus' day that were, you know, so far above everybody else and had put themselves in that position, and the oppression of the people and the poor and so forth by the social elite classes of the Israelite people, but now you throw into the mix the Roman rule. And things get even messier, say, because here's some things that are going on. The gap between the haves and the have-nots becomes wider and wider. Okay, the Jewish aristocracy collaborates with the Roman rulers so that they can maintain power. In other words, what's primarily governing their behavior and their actions, that is, the leaders of the Jews? It's certainly not God's law, you see. It's do whatever we have to please the Romans, who are really the rulers of our land, so that we can keep our positions. You see? So what's happening to this whole socioeconomic balancing act? It's pretty well gone, isn't it? You see? The Jewish masses under the time of the Romans, by the time Jesus comes along, were more oppressed by their own people even than they were by foreigners in the past. Now, go back 2,000 some odd years to the time that Jesus, as a boy and as a young man, especially as a carpenter, is growing up in this kind of an environment. Okay? Let me ask you this question. When you think of Jesus as a carpenter, maybe think about a lot of the pictures that perhaps you've seen in Bible classes and so on and so forth. What's your typical view, or how do you typically see Jesus in that capacity as a carpenter? What pictures come into your mind?
Hard work and just to make a living.
Okay.
Furniture.
Okay, making furniture.
Humble lifestyle.
Okay. You know, one of the things that I hadn't really ever thought of in this particular aspect before is that, you know, typically we think of Jesus. I think a lot of the pictures that I've seen is Jesus in his carpenter shop, you know, and he's got a little stool there, a chair that he's made, you know, and so we kind of get this idea that perhaps Jesus had, you know, he opened up his, you know, carpenter shop. Jesus of Nazareth, carpenter extraordinaire, you know, had to sign over the door, and, you know, if anybody needed a chair made or they needed something repaired, a table or whatever, you know, they'd come to Jesus and say, Jesus, I need a table. I need to be this wide, this tall, and so on and so forth. Can you handle that? And Jesus goes, no problem. See me in a week. Okay? Jesus has got his carpenter shop, right? But go back and think about the times, okay? And think about some of the people who would have needed a carpenter. Does that perhaps bring some different pictures into your mind? You see? The reason that I'm taking you down this path here is because I want you to think in terms of Jesus not sitting in his little nice carpenter shop, you know, like I have at my shop, you know. I've got a nice, you know, shop, workshop there at my house. And, you know, if you want something done, you can, you know, tell me, hey, you know, can you make this for me? And, yeah, sure, you know, what have you. But I can't build a handicap ramp at my house for your house. In order for me to build a handicap ramp, where do I need to go? I need to go to your house. You know, most likely Jesus, because he was a carpenter, you think there were any steel ships or fishing boats back in Jesus' day? No, they were made out of wood. Who takes care of wood things? Carpenters. So you think Jesus might have found himself on the shores of the Sea of Galilee, perhaps at times, before his ministry started, maybe doing some repairs on someone's fishing boat? You see? Or, you know, all kinds of things like that. In other words, the idea that Jesus, in his capacity just as a carpenter, before he started his ministry, likely did a lot of traveling around. You know, the countryside and so forth, taking care of business. And while he's doing all of this traveling, what do you suppose he might have seen? Yeah. Yeah. A whole lot of social injustice. A whole lot of oppression of the people. They, such that if you go over to Luke chapter 4, at the beginning of Jesus' ministry, okay, after a time when he would have been, you know, traveling around and seeing all of these kinds of things, Jesus begins his ministry with a particular declaration. Beginning in verse 14, he returned in the power of the Spirit to Galilee, and a report about him went out through all the surrounding company, and he taught, he taught in their synagogues, being glorified by all. Can I get somebody to read for us verses 16 through 21? Judy, go ahead.
He went to Nazareth, where he had been brought up, and on the Sabbath day he went into the synagogue, as was his custom, and he stood up to read. The scroll of the prophet Isaiah was handed to him. Unrolling it, he found a place where it is written, "The Spirit of the Lord is on me, because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners, and recovery of sight for the blind, to release the oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." Then he rolled up the scroll, gave it back to the attendant, and sat down. The eyes of everyone in the synagogue were fastened on him. 21, please.
Yeah.
And he began saying to them, "Today this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing."
Wow. When you think about the socioeconomic impact and importance of Israel and the land, and how all of those things had been being done throughout Israel's history, and Jesus being an eyewitness to this social injustice and oppression and so forth, does Jesus picking that scripture to read, does it have a different meaning perhaps to you now than maybe it ever had before? A Jesus who had probably wandered around the countryside seeing all of this social and economic injustice and oppression and so forth, says, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to do what? Proclaim good news to the poor. He sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed." And do you think that this statement in verse 19, "to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor," do you think that has anything whatsoever to do with the year of Jubilee? In other words, the time when everything was set to go back in order. That's what Jubilee meant. That's what it was really all about. It was to take everything that had been for the last 49 years had been cast aside and made in disarray because this person did this, this person sold this land, this person sold that, this person had this, and to take all of that and to put it back in order. The way that it was supposed to be, the way it was intended by God to be. So Jubilee, or the year of the Lord's favor, was a reordering of things. And Jesus is saying as He begins His ministry, that's what I'm here to do. I'm here to put things back in order, the way God intended for them to be. No wonder that Jesus, early on in His ministry, ran into disfavor with the leadership of the Jewish people. They liked the order things were in. And Jesus, beginning His ministry, announces a shake-up of the order of things. Because things have been out of order for so long. I've been going on and on and on with all of this. Anybody have any thoughts or comments in here?
I was just thinking about you saying, you know, that Jesus most likely traveled to do His work. And this is very possible because I remember back when I was a child, carpenters would pack their planes and measuring mm-hmm. stick in a knapsack, and they would travel from town to town and find work that way, you know, to prepare whatever needed to be done. So yes, Jesus most likely did exactly the same thing.
Yeah. Out of the carpenter shop into the world. Yeah. It's probably more likely that Jesus was, you know, out going to places more than He was in a, you know, located carpenter shop, so to speak.
And I remember most of these people, instead of getting paid, they would work like this for food.
Sure.
Just to eat and to stay alive.
The fact that He was recognized as Joseph's son meant that He's got a realm.
Yeah.
And
oh, yeah.
Speak in different places.
Yeah. People knew who He was. Okay, we have one other area of this part of the prophets. It has to do with political issues. That's the third and final aspect of the prophets here. We're just about out of time, so we're going to go ahead and end right here. We'll pick up with that next week or the following week, and work at finalizing this particular study here. All right, thank you all very much.